Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Payne and Pendergast into the 9 o'clock hour on Sports Radio 610. So Seth, this poll, this, not poll, but a survey that some of the Pro Bowlers... Some of the Pro Bowlers did.
Beavis laugh. Kids, this is Beavis and Butthead were these iconic.
Well, this is the 9 o'clock hour. We can be bawdier in this hour because everybody's at school.
I feel like Beavis and Butthead, by today's standards, aren't even bawdy. It was just a couple of obnoxious kids.
And a little dated, possibly.
Yeah. I wonder. You know what? I bet if you go back and watch Beavis and Butthead, there are a whole lot of like, oh, somebody said something mildly gay. Yeah.
A little dated, yeah. I loved Beavis and Butthead. Big fan.
I was watching The Office again. As you know, I'm working my way through
The
Office.
How far in are you?
I just got to the part, spoiler alerts up here, everybody, for a episode that's 15 years old, where Jim and...
the other two people that haven't watched The Office.
Jim and Pam make out, and then...
is that where you are?
Next episode, yes. So I think I'm in season two.
Yeah, if you're towards the end of season two.
I'm watching whatever Netflix is spitting out for me next.
Okay.
But I'm sitting there, and as I'm watching this Michael Scott, who, you know, back then, you know, was kind of viewed as a visionary. But now I'm watching him under the context of today and what we know. And I'm like, oh, wow, not appropriate, Michael Scott.
No.
I know when The Office first came out, everybody thought, oh, Michael Scott, this is the kind of boss you want to have. But I would
really?
Encourage you to go back and watch. And I'd say, oh, no, actually, he was quite crude.
Is that what they were thinking?
Yeah.
I'm going to tell
my grandkids that. I'm going to go back and be like, look at how stupid we were. Back then, that was the paradigm for what you wanted a boss to be.
That's a great boss. You know how you know he's a great boss? He had a coffee mug that said number one boss.
He was a guy that knew how to make insensitive jokes.
Seth, the other night, The Office, there was an Office marathon going on Comedy Central. I think there is every night on Comedy Central.
Yeah.
And Jonesy, did you watch The Office? Did you?
Oh, I love The Office.
The Office. Scott's Tots was on. Right? Like one of the greatest episodes ever. No, it's like season five. I'm like, God, Seth is going to, you have so much laughter in front of you here. I'm very jealous. Like you have so many good episodes.
To be serious, obviously I'm joking about Michael Scott ever being somebody
of course
Boston
you are.
But even like, so in season two, like, I'm not even going to say the word. I'm kind of surprised that they were criticizing him for using, like, the homophobic slur, the F word.
Right.
That
right,
F word.
Right.
They're kind of using it. Like, obviously, they're presenting it in a negative light that he's saying the word and everything.
Right.
But, like, I don't think you can get away with that anymore.
You wouldn't even be able to use the word now. Yeah.
Even in criticizing him, like, satire is completely dead.
Right.
To where even if you're presenting somebody, they're like, wow, look at what a jackass this person is.
Yeah.
People will say, well, yeah, but no, but you still shouldn't do it because it's wrong. Like, yes, we're openly saying this is wrong, you see? We're presenting this as a deplorable character.
Yep.
Yes, but you still shouldn't say it. Right. All right, fine, whatever.
Right.
Yeah. No,
just sit back and enjoy The Office, Seth.
Okay.
which NFL city did you most like to travel to?
Oh,
and I'm asking you this because they asked a bunch of the Pro Bowlers which one they want to go to. I'll tell you in their poll in a second here.
Is this the best one to travel to as a player?
Yes.
Okay, well, as a player, it's not the same as going to visit as somebody that's a tourist. Because I would say I liked going to San Diego, even though it was a dumpy stadium.
Mm-hmm.
The weather was typically nice whenever we were out there. And it just was a different environment. It was weird. You'd look up in the stands, and it was people wearing bathing suits in the just, like, a bunch of bros with their shirts off and like women in bikini tops and everything. It almost felt like you were at a pro volleyball game or something.
Yeah.
It was like that part of the, it was just a weird environment, even though it was such a crappy stadium. Those old baseball stadiums were just awful. So I liked going to San Diego. Frankly, just for the atmosphere of it, I liked going to Pittsburgh. And but that's, I guess, the stadium itself, not the city.
Everyone's got their own criteria,
yeah.
And they kind of left it open to players as to how they selected this thing.
Yeah.
Los Angeles, which is essentially the new San Diego, was the winner with six. Although I don't think that stadium in Los Angeles is going to have the same vibe as as Qualcomm in San Diego with all the San Diego bros, like you said. Los Angeles, my guess is that's going to be a stadium. I don't know, for Charger games, it'll be like Rams games. My guess is Rams games are going to be more of a marquee event.
But you're talking about, but these guys are talking about going to the Coliseum.
they...
I mean, if you're talking about L.A., I would assume
they're
talking about... Well,
and the city of L.A. as well. You know, they're just the city they like to travel to.
Okay, see, Okay, this is where I don't... This is the problem. People might not realize this. In the NFL, you get there on Saturday afternoon, and then you might go out to dinner or something, and then you have team meetings, and you go to bed, and then all of a sudden you're playing a football game. So it's not like you're traveling to that city.
And there's a player who says that. Yeah. I don't leave the hotel, so they're all the same to me.
Yeah,
so someone
yeah.
answered that, but then there are other players who get out a little bit or whatever. Anyways.
I was always jealous of these guys that could go and plunk down and like, hey, let's go to the mall and then see the Statue of Liberty and we'll do all this. I was always way too... paranoid about the next day.
Yeah,
and just
I'm doing your job.
Staying off my feet. Like, I don't want to be out and about. What if I get caught in traffic?
Right.
I always stayed very close to the hotel.
Los Angeles, 6 votes. Miami and Seattle, 4 votes. Denver and Nashville, 3 votes.
Okay.
Kansas City and Las Vegas. Las Vegas is going to get way more votes the more guys go there.
I'm going to tell you right now.
Houston did get a vote.
I'm going to tell you right now. Seattle can go kick rocks as far as going to travel there as an athlete. Because... even when it was a 2-hour, it was one thing that I was playing on the East Coast in Jacksonville. You travel kitty corner across the country.
Yep.
So it's a long ass flight. And then you get there and your body clock is all screwed up. I'm an early riser. So whenever I go to play on the West Coast, I'm up at 3 in the morning local time.
So the body clock thing is real.
Sitting outside, kind of figuring out, waiting. You know, this is before Uber. I'm like, I just want to go to a coffee shop and like sit and read the paper or something. But yeah, my body clock would be all messed up.
Yeah.
And then you go to Seattle and it's foggy and drizzly. You feel like you're in this weird state of being that's different than I. It's almost it's too funky. It's a little too like I felt like I was at a Nirvana concert and kind of getting a contact high the whole time, but in a bad way.
See, but you know which aspect of Seth Payne would like traveling to Seattle?
Yeah,
the one you explained earlier in the show. That likes to do the hey crowd,
oh, get in
hey
the
opposing
crowd,
crowd.
Yeah, getting the crowd.
And I'm waving my arms. Yeah, I'm waving my arms. Yeah, hey opposing crowd, because the Seattle crowd is very, very loud.
Denver is nice. I know Denver got 3 votes.
Denver got 3 votes.
Denver's a nice city to go to if your hotel. A lot of this comes down to where is your hotel. So a lot of these guys answering this, it's more of a testament to how good their traveling secretary is.
Stay in Lodo. It's awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Denver,
like, are you in a place where it feels like, oh, I can walk down the street and there's a bunch of good restaurants? You know, Indy, I would honestly, in a lot of ways, Indy is like that because you stay downtown and you're close to a lot of stuff. So it feels like, oh, okay, this is a pretty vibrant area.
Worst NFL city to travel to? There's a runaway winner.
Buffalo by 10 votes.
Buffalo, 10 players. Named Buffalo as the worst place to travel to.
I think Buffalo, as far as for people that do go out and get out and about, I think you usually stay, every time we ever went to Buffalo, we stayed at like a hotel near the airport. There was kind of a dingier hotel, but it's, I guess, the closest to Orchard Park. It's closest like viable hotel.
You drive
to Orchard
through the
Park.
Neighborhood in Orchard Park, right?
To like, get to Orchard,
to
which
to
I always
game.
Kind of enjoyed it because you get more contact with drunk and angry fans on the bus ride at Buffalo than almost anywhere else. So you get flipped off the entire way. You get people throwing snowballs at the bus, which is a lot of fun. But I always enjoyed that part of it because I always like to, one of my little traditions was I would flip off the fans back. As a tradition, yeah. And it was so much fun because they would just lose it. You think about like
it's like you doing the waving your arms to the crowd.
You've been out, you've been drinking since 7 in the morning,
right.
And it's gloomy out. It's always gloomy. You know, you're playing in late November or something, and you're thinking like, okay, this is going to be the highlight of my week. I'm going to flip off the bus when it comes by.
Yeah.
But then one of these spoiled professional athletes is in the window with a bleep-eaten smile on his face giving you the double birds.
This guy.
That was me. And you
were the text page what you were.
You would see the look on their faces where this guy with like a big old ugly greasy mullet is flipping you off, and he's kind of like got a smirk on his face, and then he realizes that one of the players has got a big smile and is flipping off back, and you'd see his face turned to pure rage, and they'd start running at it, like doing the like, no,
they bang on
no,
the bus?
You suck, no, you. They'd go full Bill O'Brien, and it was exactly like Bill O'Brien.
FOB.
So you'd have these legions of Bill O'Briens coming at you, screaming
you
at
suck you. Suck too, pal. That's great. Where is the city you least like to go to in your career?
Tennessee. It's a vile place.
Tennessee
it's a
got
loathsome, despicable place.
Tennessee got no votes.
Tennessee's like the. It's almost like Vegas without any of the appeal or charm, but all of the sin, but none of the sin that you know. Like Vegas, you go to like, oh, well, I'm surrounded by sin, and it's kind of appealing. You go to Tennessee, and it's like I'm surrounded by sin, and God help me if I ever end up like these people, rolling around giving each other diseases with their meth pipes hanging out of their pockets and they're riding hogs to work and whatever okay. else they do.
That's okay. Just so I'm clear, that's Tennessee. That's Nashville.
Yeah.
Indianapolis is. Those are the inbred, right?
Yeah, mostly.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just making sure. I lose track of you. The other AFC South.
Yeah. Tennessee just has no. You know, I feel like in Indianapolis they at least have shame. I feel like in Indiana, they at least are ashamed of how pathetic they are. Nashville, there's not even any shame.
They think there's something there.
It's a kind of like they take a certain amount of pride in like, I ain't never been to school. You know, like that kind of that. Like, yeah, man tried to make me to go to school. And Pappy said no by second grade. I was out riding hogs.
They've got T-shirts that say that and it's spelled S-K-O-O-L.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
I ain't never been to school. Cincinnati, 4 votes. Green Bay, 4 votes. Oakland, 4 votes.
Oh, no. I think in Indiana, it's the illiteracy. The it's like a 48% illiteracy rate there.
Indiana or Tennessee?
Indiana.
Wow.
Yeah, they're actually quite literate in Tennessee.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tennessee Williams.
Mm.
Yeah. He was actually, I think it was like New Orleans, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know
yeah, well, the whole thing about you know what Tennessee did is they booted out Sam Houston.
They
you
did?
Know, Sam Houston was the, yeah, they, and it was, I've never quite been, I've watched a couple documentaries on Sam Houston, but they were produced by, you know, the Sam Houston Historical Society, and they never really quite go into exactly what happened in Tennessee and what scandal there was that had him leave.
Their loss is our gain.
Yeah.
All right.
Get the ball going towards the front court. Gordon out, clear path to the hoop! 48 for Eric Gordon.
That was last night. Eric Gordon, 48 of his 50. He wound up scoring 50 points. He made 2 free throws at the end of the game. Craig Ackerman, who was doing play-by-play for the game, was on his edge. It felt like he was on the edge of his seat for those 2 free throws, like he had money on him or something. He wanted Eric Gordon to score 50 so badly in that game. The Rockets now have 3 guys who've gone over 40 this year, James Harden, Russell Westbrook, and Eric Gordon. They beat the Jazz last night, maybe the most improbable win that I can remember for the Rockets in a long, long time. No Harden, no Westbrook, no Capella against the hottest team in basketball at their place in elevation on a back-to-back.
And you're going in incredibly small versus a team that has Rudy Gobert on it.
That's
the one of the you would think, oh, boy, death, doom, and destruction. You've got the Defensive Player of the Year. Oh, wait, not the Defensive Player of the Year from last year. Or was that the All-Star game? He was Defensive Player of the Year last year, wasn't he?
He's always in the mix.
Whatever.
I think he may have been.
Yeah. When did he cry?
He cried when he didn't make the All-Star team last year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was snubbed from the All-Star team, and he wept like a little baby.
Mm.
Like a little Utah B.I.
Now he can't even beat the Rockets without their 3 best players.
It is a pretty good plan when you think about it, though, right? Like, hey, we're going up against this team. Let's not fight them with conventional weapons.
Right.
Let's do something a little unconventional.
Asymmetrical warfare.
This is
the equivalent of sending a virus to their internet.
We put a
virus in their internet in the form of these tiny little virus-like players.
It is weird. I mean, the Rockets have been very up and down lately. They had the 4-game losing streak. They won a couple games. Then they lose in Denver, which, you know, that was just a weird day on Sunday with everything that happened with Kobe. Actually, Rudy Gobert is the 2-time defending defensive player of the year.
Yeah.
So he's looking to defend. So back to the Rockets. It is strange that a win that might kind of give this team a little bit of a boost, that may galvanize them a little bit, that may kind of give them a push to get them back to playing how they were earlier in the season, would be a game where none of their star players are playing in it. No disrespect to Eric Gordon.
I think it was either Red 94 or Stanford KP last night who said, okay, would we trust the full Rockets lineup to beat this Rockets lineup? Would we trust the healthy Rockets team to beat last night's Rockets team?
If we could simulate these two teams on a computer,
yeah.
In a world where Austin Rivers could theoretically be going against Austin Rivers.
I would say they put out more defensively last night than you could have.
Well, the energy and the effort was at where it should be in an NBA game at all times.
Which you can't necessarily predict with the Rockets from one game to the next. So,
no, you cannot.
So there's a chance that several times out of 10, last night's Rockets team might have beat the normal Rockets
team. Well, here's the thing, and this is actually a good segue into what we want to talk about in this segment, which is it time to worry about James Harden, is that if James Harden doesn't start shooting the basketball better, Seth, there are not a lot of teams that the Rockets are going to beat that they're going to need to beat come April and May.
Yeah.
He's in this horrific shooting slump right now. Now, he's dealing with this injury that he suffered in that Minnesota game on Friday night, the contusion to his left thigh. So it's going to be the Russell Westbrook show on Wednesday night against Portland, Russell Westbrook and Eric Gordon. And right now we know one of the things wrong with James Harden is he's got an injury to his leg, but he wasn't playing well before that injury.
His shot is off, and I think when your go-to shot is an incredibly hard shot that few people in the NBA even try doing consistently, then it stands to reason that maybe when your shot goes off, it goes way off, mm-hmm. and it's going to be harder to fix. And I know at least part of it was he has a tendency to fade off to his right after he takes a shot, and that's kind of historically tied to what he was getting away with it for a while, and then I think all of a sudden everything kind of jumped up and grabbed him and bit him. But I wonder if a lot of it this year is even as simple as he's always obviously the subject of a lot of attention by defenses. This year they took it to an extreme to where they're trapping him so often, and he's learned how to deal with it. But I wonder if just the constant toll that takes has somehow, even all of us over the last couple seasons, has somehow finally taken its toll. I'll go back to this time last year when he had to carry the entire team on his back for as long as he did.
God, that was a year ago.
Yeah.
The 30-point-per-game stretch.
I remember, and you had to watch as everybody was talking about how James Harden was like, can they win this way? Is this the right way to play basketball? And everybody's ignoring the fact that Chris Paul was injured. And that, right. No, that you had to do this.
Capella was hurt.
It was, oh my gosh, can everybody just go back in your mind for 1 year ago and remember how the whole damn NBA world had gone mad and acted like James Harden was doing this just because he wanted to get the points.
Oh, by the way, they went 21-11 in those 32 games.
And he's scoring plus 30 every single night because he was the only guy that could score points for you. It was ridiculous. It was absurd. But if the cumulative toll, because, you know, last night Kevin McHale was talking about, hey, you want to talk about load management, James Harden is not going to ever go abide by load management.
When he misses
time and minutes, it's because he's injured. At some point, as loath as we are to acknowledge or accept load management, I feel like Harden
could use a little bit of load management. Yeah. What are some juicier theories, do you think?
Chinese poisoning.
Did you finish the question?
Yes.
Juicier theories behind James Harden's swoon. Chinese poisoning?
I think anything that goes wrong with the Rockets this year, I think we've been a little too slow to blame the Chinese for any and all of this. This is what they, do you know what they call?
This should go well.
Do you know what they call the Rockets on Chinese television right now?
Yes, I do. Tell the audience.
The red team.
Yeah.
They won't even acknowledge the Rockets by name. It's like a horror show character or something.
It's like OJ referring to himself on his YouTube videos. He can't even, or his Twitter videos.
He can't even say his own name.
He calls himself yours truly. Hey, Twitter world, it's me, yours truly.
It's me, yours truly.
He's so disgusted
with himself. Yours truly.
He can't even say his own name.
So the Rockets, I guess earlier in the year, they wouldn't even mention them or acknowledge them over on Chinese television. Now they call them the red team.
Okay, so is this the beginning of a reconciliation at least?
We talked about asymmetrical warfare just this segment. A little bit of asymmetrical warfare on the Rockets might be, I don't know, if not straight out poisoning, I don't know, sending various forms of entertainment to his place, to his condo, or what have you. I don't know.
You think the Chinese are sending ladies of the night to James Harden's room?
What teams used to try with Lawrence Taylor?
And it worked.
It didn't. It blew up in their faces.
Well, I'm sure he signed for the women that they sent to him, but it just didn't.
It didn't affect his
performance. It didn't affect him.
If anything, with Lawrence
like
Taylor,
General Zod,
it's going to keep him at home and he's going to get a good night's sleep. You know, that's the problem. It's like
kept him out of the clubs.
Yeah.
It's funny. Other theories on this?
There's the simple mechanical issues with his shot.
Yeah.
The overwork and the stress of the constant double teams. Yeah. I think that's part of it. I don't know. I'm sure people are finding a way to blame D'Antoni for this somehow. And it's amazing how, yet again, so last year where the Rockets were incredibly slow and paced, people were calling that D'Antoni ball.
Yeah.
And now this year it's the exact opposite. And now this is D'Antoni ball. All this ISO, this D'Antoni ball is not working. ISO is not D'Antoni ball, you jackasses. Like, D'Antoni's just doing what's working.
Right.
D'Antoni ball since D'Antoni has been in Houston, D'Antoni ball has basically been, all right, what's working with this crew of guys and mm-hmm. what's working with James Harden? And, ISO tends to work with James Harden.
Yeah. So the D'Antoni magic only working with one guard at a time.
Oh, that was the Lockdown Rockets podcast. I heard they were talking about that. Okay. That was just, he said it jokingly.
Gotcha. Okay. So the Rockets, so they beat the Jazz last night. The trade deadline's got to be coming up pretty soon, right? Does Daryl Morey make any moves at the trade deadline?
With what?
I don't know.
He's like Rocky at the end of Rocky V when Tommy Gunn says he's going to sue him, and he says, "Sue me for what?"
Yeah,
that's what you say.
Yep. That's and they I don't think they're ready to maneuver above the luxury tax. It feels like Daryl Morey is kind of pinned.
I think that one thing that I feel like we've seen a little bit more off-ball movement from Harden as of late. And D'Antoni had some interesting quotes of this a couple weeks ago where he said, you know, like how much do you really want Harden, who's already got an incredibly high usage rate, running around without the ball too? Is that what we really need to do? Do you need to turn him into a Steph Curry? He's a different type of player than Steph Curry, and he can create his own shot. And I think there's times and elements, especially for the ambush quality of it, when you see Harden gets involved with the ball out of his hands and you start being able to play a more intricate screen game and what have you. It doesn't have to be a steady diet of it, but when it's something that, like, all of a sudden you get this kamikaze attack and it's not something the defense is ready for, it can get things moving,
yeah,
and get things rolling. And I think we've seen that in spells here. It's just a matter of kind of refining it.
Did you, just shifting gears for a second, we've not talked much Kobe Bryant today. I think we're kind of, you know, we're tapering back into other things, as you can tell today. But the Allen Iverson post, some of these players waited a day or two to react to it because of the emotion involved. We didn't hear from LeBron James until yesterday on Kobe Bryant passing away. Allen Iverson was another one we didn't hear from until Monday. His post actually includes a very funny story. What made me think of it was you talking about Lawrence Taylor staying in his room as opposed to going out to the clubs.
Yeah,
I don't know if you saw this. And we talked about the connection with Iverson and Kobe yesterday, about how the two of them, to their respective basketball cities, probably mean very similar things. You know, that Kobe was in Los Angeles his whole career, but Allen Iverson, even though he wasn't a career Sixer, is viewed as a Philadelphia 76er, and he's embraced by Philadelphia still, even though he played for Denver and Detroit and Memphis down the stretch of his career. But the two of them were part of the same draft. Allen Iverson was the number one overall pick in the draft that Kobe was drafted in 1996. Allen Iverson starts his post by saying, you know, the usual stuff about words can't express how I'm feeling. Two words ring in my head, devastated and heartbroken. I can't shake this feeling. People will always remember how we competed against each other in the league, but it goes much deeper than that. The story of us being drafted in arguably the deepest draft class ever in the NBA can be debated for years to come. There's one memory of Kobe that I can't stop thinking about. It was our rookie season, my first trip to LA for a game against the Lakers. Kobe came to my hotel, picked me up, and took me to a restaurant. So these guys are probably, Kobe's probably 17, and Iverson's like 19 or 20 at the time.
Yeah.
When we returned, before he left, he asked me, "What are you going to do tonight?" My reply was, "I'm going to the club. What are you going to do?" Kobe said, "I'm going to the gym."
Yeah. And that sounds right. That's what, like, with Kobe.
Both are on brand.
Yeah. It's interesting, too. Iverson's one of those guys where you wonder, all right, if he had done everything that Kobe had done in terms of his preparation and whatnot, what would Iverson have been like? And I almost wonder if it wouldn't have worked for Iverson. Would have been, he's kind of like one of these, Iverson was like one of these writers from the 1930s, like Hemingway or something. If he had sobered Hemingway up and made him like go to work in an office with a tie every day on, his writing probably would have sucked. I feel like Iverson would have been the same way too. If you tried to put the clamps and restrict anything about him and his life or everything, it just wouldn't have been the same. It wouldn't have had the desired effect. Kobe just was born to be the way he was.
Yeah, and I think to that end, I think they both fit into the respective cities they were part of perfectly.
You know what? Same one, like Manning and Favre.
Favre
got, when he cleaned himself up and got off the painkillers and everything, it was good for his career because he'd never win a Super Bowl again. But I felt like he became a more consistent quarterback.
He did. There's some randomness built into not winning a Super Bowl.
He won the Super Bowl after the painkillers. It was the season before.
Yeah, the painkillers were early in his career.
Yeah. He got clean, and then that next season he went to the Super Bowl.
Yep, 1996. Man, AI is right. That draft was pretty bananas.
I knew I played with a guy who played with Favre and was actually the guy that was scoring the painkillers for
Are you serious?
Yeah. Well, wow. For himself too. They had a there was a veteran that they knew that had a prescription.
Had a hookup.
Yeah. And it was back in those days they hadn't really clamped down on the pain meds the same way, and
they were
flowing fast and easily.
Yeah, no, the internet's brought a lot of control to these things.
Favre checked himself in for help. He didn't get caught or anything. He checked himself in because he started having seizures. He was taking like 20 Vicodins a day and keeping up his drinking lifestyle too, which was not a mild one.
Oh, yeah. We had a listener text us and then tweet us. I guess Jimmy Fallon had a really good Kobe Bryant story. I'll listen to it after the show. It's tough to do stuff during a break and then say, hey, put this, we'll go play this. But it made me think, J.J. Watt is on Saturday Night Live this Saturday. I believe he's up in New York now getting ready for his appearance up there on Saturday Night Live. You know, they don't just wing these things. You got to rehearse and you got to cut promos and things like that. This will be the first Saturday Night Live since Kobe Bryant passed away. Do you think they'll do some sort of tribute on Saturday Night Live to Kobe Bryant? It will have been a week by then.
Yeah, they'll definitely do something.
Kobe ever host Saturday Night Live?
I don't know.
I feel like he would have at some point.
I was trying to think.
He's
too,
a big enough star to.
I was trying to remember if Kobe Bryant and J.J. Watt had ever been seen together publicly. And I know J.J. tweeted some nice things, but he didn't tweet any photos out of those two together. So I'm guessing that he's
doing a Google image right
doesn't
now.
Sounds like I don't think J.J. necessarily will have so many great Kobe Bryant stories. If SNL does something with Kobe, obviously it's always very, you have to be very careful in a situation like this. They're going to do something related to people's reaction to it somehow. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't mean do a skit on it. I just mean some sort of, you know, maybe a bumper at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
They dedicate that show to him and they show a silhouette of him. I'm not saying.
No, I would bet. No, I think there'll be a skit about it.
Do you really?
Yeah. Yeah. And it will be like, it'll be just something more about like the reaction to it or the way people are.
Okay.
Something. Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And 6 days is a comedy equals tragedy plus time.
They came out and did not, you know, after 9/11, they were out within 2 weeks, I think.
Were they?
And they handled it pretty well.
Okay.
Because they had Giuliani came out front and it was Lorne Michaels. If I remember correctly, Lorne Michaels was out on stage with Rudy Giuliani and Lorne Michaels asked Rudy Giuliani, he said, Mr. Mayor, is it okay to be funny? And Giuliani looked at him and said, why start now? And it was a pretty joke to start
that's
off
pretty
with.
Good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. So maybe they're working
and
overtime.
They started off now with that. They came out with, and I want to say there were a bunch of firefighters and policemen and police people out on stage as well at the beginning of that.
So okay. That makes sense.
They handled it like with the right amount of tact.
I trust
you still
them.
Find that humor.
Yeah.
Think about at a funeral sometimes. There's some good laughing that goes on at the wake afterwards.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of just you strike the right tone.
That's what I want at wake.
You're not at the wake telling your dirtiest stories, but you're telling funny stories about the person.
Permission to tell dirty stories at my wake.
Yeah, okay.
If you'd like to, Seth.
I don't have any much. I didn't know you when you were younger.
Yeah,
I have very few dirty stories
you
about
make
you.
Make some stuff up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. It's just make some things up. You know, steal some other people's story, but just insert my name into it. Dallas Keuchel. This stuff all happened on Friday and Saturday, so we're just getting a chance to get to it now. But I think it's worth touching on here because pitchers and catchers are going to be starting up pretty soon. The Astros should have a manager pretty soon, by the way. That's something that we're Jonesy's just shrugging his shoulders. And they're like, yeah, whatever you say, dude. No, February 3rd was the drop dead date that they had talked about. Jim Crane had talked about. So they'll get one here soon, Jonesy. Dallas Keuchel. I say he issued an apology. He was getting love on Twitter over the weekend from being the first 2017 Astro to actually say the words, I'm sorry. But let's judge this, Seth, and I'm sure you've heard this already. But here is Dallas Keuchel's quote-unquote apology for the 2017 Astros sign stealing.
I mean, I'm not going to go into specific detail, but during the course of the playoffs in 17, everybody was using multiple signs. For factual purposes, when there's nobody on base, when in the history of Major League Baseball has there been multiple signs? So you can go back and watch film of every team in the playoffs. There was probably 6 out of 8 teams using multiple signs. So it's just what the state of baseball was at that point in time. Was it against the rules? Yes, it was. And, you know, I personally am sorry for what's come about, the whole situation. But it is what it is, and we got to move past that. So I never thought anything would have come like it did, and I myself am sorry, but we got to move on.
Well, and I want to say with Keuchel especially, Keuchel had some bad cross-up moments in that. And there were guys who were getting crossed. That's what's happened with the playoffs the last few years is guys are getting crossed up all the time because they're changing signs so much. If anybody should be upset about all this, it's the catchers. Not just because of the stealing signs, but because of the extra work and that they get.
Right.
They end up looking like the buffoons when they didn't realize a curveball was
coming.
Poor
Brian McCann.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, think about McCullers, too. Yeah. Like, McCullers having to switch his signs all the time and his curveball. Yeah, poor Brian McCann trying to catch a Lance McCullers curveball.
Yeah. I don't know. When I heard Dallas Keuchel apologized, and I get it, he was on that team, and he won a ring.
Yeah.
There was part of me that's like, okay, well, is it easier for him to apologize because he's not on the team anymore?
Well, and because he wasn't directly involved with it. He theoretically, and he said this too in another part of his interview, he theoretically benefited from it, you know, but he said they weren't doing it every night, and this, that, the other thing, whatever. Are you trying to minimize it? I don't know. I think it's easier for the pitchers to apologize.
Yeah.
You know, when Justin Verlander got up and accepted an award from the Baseball Writers of America, and he made a comment about how he wasn't, as far as I could tell, he just made a comment about how the Astros were very analytically advanced, and it,
did you get good audio on it? I could barely hear what
hear.
He said. Yeah,
it said it was received with derisive laughter.
Okay,
so I don't know. That's
so he wasn't cracking
that's
a
inferring
joke.
Inferring a whole lot of emotion from a bunch of different people that are
right.
laughing. So I don't know if people are laughing, saying like, "Yeah, whatever." Analytically advanced. Well, yeah, they are. I mean, him pointing that out doesn't change the fact that a lot of the stuff that happens with the pitching, the pitchers were not the ones that benefited from this. Like the pitchers benefited from the run support. Theoretically, but it's not like the sign stealing was why Verlander had this historically incredible numbers
right.
over the last few years.
That's
it's
right.
just so to somehow make Justin Verlander the object of your the object of your hate, especially when Verlander showed up in September. Verlander wasn't even on the damn team for the vast majority of the time that it happened.
Yeah.
And somehow he's being treated with the same scorn as everybody else. That part of it like genuinely angers me.
It would have been interesting if Verlander came in and told him to stop doing it. Like, he's there the first week.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, guys, you know, like.
That's what he was yelling when he came out of the dugout with his shirt off, when he poked his head into the dugout. He's like, guys, stop.
Stop banging the garbage can.
What if Verlander had come out and he had the garbage can in his hands with his shirt off? Remember his shoulder was wrapped and he had his shirt off and you're like, wow, Verlander's hairier than I would have thought. But yeah, go get him, Verlander.
He is hairier.
Why is he holding the garbage can?
Yeah. No, he went up a couple notches in my mind when he walked out without a shirt on. I'm like, that dude has Kate Upton.
Yeah.
And he's got a dad bod.
So Keuchel is one of our texters points out. It was an apology, but also saying it was everyone.
Yeah, it was kind of a not sorry kind of deal.
There was an arms race.
Yeah.
It was this fear that the Red Sox, who had already been nailed for it that season, and the Yankees were actually, I think on a part of the Astros may have felt that the Yankees and the Red Sox were doing things far advanced to anything that's been reported.
Yeah.
So that's where, boy, you know, Red Sox fans know that they're in for something. The Yankees fans that want to take any kind of a high and mighty approach on this, they better be really.
Yeah, dude.
We're all saving the receipts, everybody.
Yeah.
Like, stuff's coming out, you know.
They need to be walking around like that mob soldier that knows he wronged somebody.
Yeah.
And he could be the next one to get popped by the family from one of the other five boroughs.
Yeah.
Like, you're just walking around like, kind of looking around to see who's, you know, before you start walking down the sidewalk, any shady characters here?
You know what they should do is walk around with one of Babe Ruth's notoriously corked bats for protection. Get a little action off somebody's skull when they try to attack.
It would be ironic.
Yeah.
By the way, Twitter is the worst. Did you see Verlander's expressing his sympathy to Kobe Bryant's family? And what is, it just turns into a bunch of replies. Here are the replies. Justin Verlander tweets this on Sunday afternoon at 2:10 p.m. So this is an hour after the helicopter crash, Justin Verlander tweets, no words, absolutely heartbroken for Kobe's family, hashtag RIP Kobe. Here are the first set of replies to that tweet. Okay, cheater.
Yeah.
Let's see. Now you speak up, huh, tainted champ? Shocked you aren't joking and laughing about this, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Cheater, RIP Kobe. There's someone that just puts a gif of a... It's like Stephen Colbert holding a bag saying "ho bag."
But this is where, I try not to let social media get me down too much, because obviously it's not the time and place when somebody's expressing condolences for something, yeah, except for a certain element on Twitter when you're going to be anonymous and just. And this is key and most important. In times like this, make yourself feel morally superior to somebody else, right, which is what that you got to stay off social media when you feel genuinely bad about somebody passing away or something. You just got to stay off, because for the 99% positive you're going to see 1% of, oh my gosh, how could you be that awful of a human being, yeah, like what the hell's wrong with you,
yeah,
and it ruins your whole day,
yeah,
and you just gotta, yeah, unless you can genuinely just slough it off, you gotta remove yourself from it.
I think you gotta do what I think McClain does. This is what I think McClain does on Twitter,
yeah,
is he just doesn't look at his replies or his mentions. The only mentions he looks at are people who he's also following,
yeah,
or verified.
You know, I didn't know that before I got back into the media and I was just a retired player, and he had tweeted a couple things. And I responded to him like 2 or 3 times and he never responded back to me.
How did you take that?
I was insulted. I was personally insulted. But he wasn't following me on Twitter or anything. He wouldn't have known. He just genuinely doesn't check his replies. I assume he would have responded to me if he had seen that it was
yeah,
it's Seth Payne, baby.
Yeah, you know? Of course. Yeah. Do you know who the hell I am? Yeah. Did you guys ever bury the hatchet, or is this something?
No, I realized that he's bubbling
underneath every McClain appearance, because he's with us tomorrow at 8:00.
Yeah.
He's not at the Super Bowl.
Yeah, no, it's not bubbling under everyone.
All right.
When you have as many Twitter followers as he does, even if he was checking his mentions, you just don't see everything.
Sheer volume, yeah. Did you see this character, this Dan Clark Sports, as long as we're talking about the Astros?
He claims that he lost all these followers because he lost all these Houston followers because they didn't want unbiased reporting.
He tweeted this. Just looking at some analytics, and this is a guy named Dan Clark Sports. He's a sports writer. His bio is sports writer, brutally honest. Mm-hmm. That's all it says.
Ugh.
He has about 32,000 Twitter followers. Just looking at some analytics, approximately 2 months ago, I had almost 2,000 followers from Houston and the surrounding areas. Now that number is just under half that. That speaks volumes of the fan base, only interested in reading pro-Astros stories from biased local media who deny.
Yeah, yeah. And then you go through his timeline, you realize, like, oh, he's saying a whole bunch of snarky stuff about Houston all the time.
All the time.
I'm imagining that the Houston followers you've lost are probably more based on something like that. I would also say, I would caution anybody on reading too much into those Twitter analytics. Have you ever taken a look at your Twitter analytics?
I have.
Have you? I don't trust them. I don't trust them for a single little bit. If you look at some of them, like, it'll break down your number of followers, like your followers and what their income. Mine, it claims that like 30% of my followers make over $200,000 a year or something.
Cool.
Let's see.
Easy to get a loan.
Okay, so 12% of them apparently make between $150,000 and $199,000.
That's weird.
And and then there's some that are even more than that, apparently. I don't believe that.
Okay. And the Astros, were we just saying this like 10 minutes ago? Jonesy, you were sort of sneering when I said the Astros are going to name a manager by February 3rd. It's almost like they're listening to Sports Radio 610, because the Astros have named a manager. Dusty Baker will be the manager of the 2020 Houston Astros. Dusty Baker, who...
Man long renowned for his heavy analytical mind.
Not at all. good manager.
He's old school, though. In a good way. I'm saying in a good way. It's just that was the big question of it is, all right, is whatever the front office personality is, and this is a mistake I keep making. I kind of keep thinking about the Astros organization being exactly what it was when Jeff Luhnow was here, which is one of the most analytically advanced organizations in baseball. We don't know for sure what the new GM is going to be like or what he's going to look like, but Dusty Baker, who has obviously a great baseball mind and a very human touch, but is more of an old school guy, is how is he going to adapt to being in this environment?
Yep.
But we don't know what the environment is.
Yeah, no, that's right. They still need to find a GM as well. But Dusty Baker, when the Astros take off for pitchers and catchers, when spring training starts, Dusty Baker will be the manager of the Houston Astros. God, this is wild, man. If someone had told you a month ago that Dusty Baker would be the manager of the Astros, I'd be like, man, what year is it? Yeah, it's 2020, and John Lopez jumps in with us right now. John, in all your travels with the Chronicle and covering sports, covering baseball, I'm sure you've had a chance to cross paths with Dusty Baker at some point.
Oh, yeah.
What are your thoughts on this hire?
I like him a lot. Now, my thoughts on the hire are probably a little different. This is almost like a bounce-back girlfriend. You know, after a long relationship, you know, you just have that safe, mom likes them. You know, just kind of a
65-year-old that makes questionable lineup decisions.
A good solid, you know, transitional girlfriend.
Right.
I don't think that's a bad thing per se.
If we're going to go with an old school guy, between the two old school guys, Buck Showalter and Dusty Baker, I would say would be the most old schoolish guys out there. I much prefer Dusty Baker.
100%.
I don't want to have to deal with Buck Showalter's shtick coming in here and probably wanting to act like he was the new sheriff in town and whatnot. I'm going to get along with Dusty Baker a lot more as a fan, I think.
Now we have a bunch of things we were going to talk about. Now Dusty's going to obviously take some of that. I think it's also the most non, as you said, Seth, analytical, non-decoding signs manager there is.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to be old school, do it that way. No, he's also...
Wait a second. You just combined analytics with stealing signs. I don't think that's fair.
No, it's not fair. But you know what I mean? He's going to be just old school. He's not going to be all into all this other stuff.
I do think that's a, you know, if you're Jim Crane and you're asking the question, what do I want in a manager, if you just fired AJ Hinch solely because he lost control of that aspect of the clubhouse, I'm not saying he lost control of the clubhouse, he lost control of the players doing something that put the team in harm's way, that compromised the team, that tainted a championship, I would think at the very top of the list of traits that you're looking for in his replacement is somebody where the answer is the right answer to the question, is this going to happen on his watch?
Right,
is elicited.
Yeah,
right?
and I think that's where I would go immediately as well with Dusty Baker. Now he's not a long term solution.
Right,
you know, he's a bridge. He's a bridge from then to whomever comes next. But I think he's old enough that they'll respect him. You know, in terms of a leader of men more than be his best friend, and I think they need that.
Yeah, that's interesting too. The part about he's not long term. I think for the first time in this specific era of Astros baseball, John, that the window A feels shorter and B feels definitive. Like to me, the window is, I know Altuve's still going to be on the team and Bregman's still going to be on the team. You're talking about competing with the New York Yankees now.
Right.
To me, the window is the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
When Verlander and Greinke's contracts are up, that's the window right now because there's no solutions that we've seen that are going to replace those two guys, unless they re-sign those two guys.
Sure. And I would say, too, I don't want to jump into, hey, Dusty Baker's old, so he must not abide by the analytics. The Nationals in 2017 were the 15th most shifting team in baseball. So they employed the shift the 15th most oftentimes. So they were like middle of the road. It's not like he's going to be anti-analytics or anything.
No, I don't mean that. I think he's just going to be like doing it the old-fashioned way, just do it the right way. I think he's safe. I really do. He thinks a safe manager. I do like the way they did the search a lot. I thought they went through a lot of guys. You know, Jim Crane got a lot of different opinions and information and decided, you know, this is the guy.
I saw some people criticizing them for having so many managerial
candidates. I didn't mind
that at all. I thought, especially when it's... You're doing it, I think typically you do think about 9 different guys. It's just that you're doing it over a longer time period and not all of them make the light of day publicly. So this made sense.
I think sometimes people don't understand that a lot of times people like Jim Crane interview people with no thought of hiring that person. They interview them to get intel and get ideas and things like that.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to put it this way. He interviewed a bunch of people maybe for the next managerial open.
Could be.
You know, like I want to find out about, you know, whomever this guy is, one of the young guys, you know, Bannister or whomever. And because I'm going to probably hire Dusty Baker, but I want to know I want to pick these guys' brains and see if they can be the next guy.
Yeah. Oh, is Landry okay? Does he know this news? I know he is a card-carrying Jeff Bannister lover.
He is exactly that. He's sucking his thumb, laying down underneath the table in a fetal position.
So you're going to try to nurse him back to health over the next 4 hours.
Get him back on his feet.
Gotcha. What else is going on the show?
Let me ask you guys this question. This is something we're going to do one segment. If you could trade one player from the Texans for one player on the Super Bowl rosters, who would it be?
Oh wow. Boy, I got to think about that one.
Would a JJ Frabosa interest you?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Honestly, even if JJ were completely healthy, that's just an age thing. That's a hard question because I feel like honestly, realistically, like 10 or 15.
Well, yeah,
but I could say that with a lot of teams. That's not even a knock on the Texans.
No. Yeah.
So which one is the one from that? Yeah. If you could just have free reign to swap a player for player.
Well, some of them are obvious, like any tight end for Kittle or for Kelsey.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's the number one?
I see what you're saying. You're talking about at same position.
A legit player at the same position.
I got you. Okay, yeah. I just thought a trade. You just said could trade one player. You didn't mention the position thing. Yeah. Okay.
At the same position.
Okay, gotcha.
So we're going to do a little bit of that. We're 5 days away from the Super Bowl, so we're going to kick that off.
All right, good deal. John, we look forward to it. In the Loop, John Lopez, Landry Locker. They've got you. If you just missed it, Dusty Baker, the new manager of the Houston Astros. I'm sure John and Landry will have full coverage and opinion on that as well. Seth, I will see you tomorrow bright and early, my friend.
Maybe.
All right, then. We'll see you tomorrow at 6 a.m., everybody.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.